John Munson in for Joy Cardine with a very special edition of On Your Money today. Kevin McKinley off this week. On this week, it's On Your Money's nationally renowned personal finance expert, Gene Chatsky, who has an interesting piece of advice for people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. Tips for reducing monthly student loan payments, getting financially ready for major life events, and resolving common money fights between men and women. What's your personal finance question today? If you're in your 50s, 60s, and 70s, what investment-related questions do you have? Well, here's the number to call, 800-642-1234. Email address is onyourmoney@wpr.org, or you can post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Gene Chatsky is the financial editor for NBC's Today Show, host of the new Her Money podcast, financial ambassador to AARP, and the author of several books. She also grew up in Madison, and her dad taught at the University of Wisconsin. Gene, welcome to On Your Money.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So AARP launched a special digital magazine this month, and in it you wrote an article with some investing tips for people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. First off, how are people in these age groups generally sitting? I mean, do they largely have their finances in order, or are they in a bit of trouble?
Unfortunately, no matter what age group you look at these days, people are not as well prepared as they should be. And part of the reason for that is that life is just lasting a lot longer, and retirement is lasting a lot longer. And so while our parents and grandparents had these pensions that would take them through whatever later years they had, the years after a paycheck ended, today's retirees are reliant on their 401ks, their IRAs, coupled with Social Security, and they need the money to last a lot longer than any of them expected.
Well, you laid out a rule of thumb for people in their 50s as far as what they should have saved. Explain that for us.
So these guidelines are not mine originally. They were put together by the folks at Fidelity Investments. And essentially, it takes a look at how much of your income you should have saved by the time you reach particular ages. And so since the DigiMag actually came out, these guidelines have been revised. So the numbers that you're looking at are not the ones that I'm going to quote for you. But by age 50, you want to make sure that you've got about six times your income, and it's your current income, not your future at retirement income, put away. By the time you reach age 60, you want to have eight times, and by the time you retire, typically at around age 67, you want to have 10 times. And if you're not there, it's not really a cause to panic, but it is a cause to reassess.
Well, I'm glad it's not a cause to panic because I'm 63 and I am nowhere near any of that. So I'm in trouble.
You're not in trouble, but you need to take a look, and so do many people, at how you're living now, how you expect that you'll live in retirement, and what sort of changes you can make in order to make your money last as long as you do. One of the nice things that we're seeing about people who are currently in retirement is that they're very flexible as far as their spending goes. When I first started reporting on personal finance, there was this rule of thumb that everybody thought was a real, actually hard and fast rule, that you needed to have 80% of your pre-retirement money once you retired coming in income on a regular basis. What we know from looking at the way people who are retired are spending today is that number dips up and down and then back up again. We tend in our lifetimes to spend the most money. Our heavy spending years come in our late 40s and early 50s. They tend to come when your kids are in college, which makes total sense. I mean, college costs an arm and a leg and is very expensive. But after your kids launch which may take a while these days, but after after they launch, spending tapers off a bit, but you're still healthy. Maybe you're not commuting as much as you were, but you're not also paying for the college bills, the big family vacations, the other things. Spending tapers off a bit, and then it doesn't really start to climb again until you're at the very end of life when healthcare expenses pick up.
So, if how should people in their 60s be managing their investments?
So, I think that the important thing to realize in your 60s is that you've got a lot of time left. I mean, 60 is young. And you could live another 30, another 40 years. And what that means is you need exposure to the stock markets. You retirement used to be a time when people would talk about really tapering off the amount of money that they had in stocks. Today, you need a sizable portion of your nest egg exposed to the stock market, because with interest rates, especially where they are, that's the only place that you are going to be able to capture significant growth over the long term. Now, there are a number of different ways to accomplish that. I mean, one strategy that we've seen a lot of people who are heading into retirement veering toward is a strategy that buys them some sort of a regular paycheck or a regular income, whether they do that by investing their money in dividend-paying stocks or by buying an annuity that essentially guarantees some sort of paycheck for life. And before everybody's hackles go up, let me just say that when I talk about annuities, I'm really talking about very simple annuities. There are income, immediate pay income annuities where you essentially take a sum of money and you convert it to a paycheck that can last for life. And that's about it as far as the transaction goes. There's not a lot of other machinations in the annuity contract. Now, because interest rates are so low, it's not a good time to take your entire nest egg and annuitize. The payouts on annuities are based on your age. They're based on interest rates, but because interest rates are so low, you're not going to get an especially great return right now. And so if annuitizing is a strategy that appeals, then you may want to think about building a ladder of immediate annuities, kind of the way you would build a bond ladder, that you buy one now and then you buy another one 5 years down the road, and you sort of do it over time. But annuitizing to cover your fixed expenses coupled with Social Security is I think, a smart thing to consider. The other thing that people in their 60s need to be really conscious of is the decision about when to tap Social Security. If we look at people in this country and when they are taking Social Security, the vast majority of them are taking it at age 62. And that's a very expensive mistake, because if you look at the if you look at your paychecks from Social Security, they go up about 8% a year guaranteed for every year that you wait between age 62 and age 70 in order to start Social Security. And so it's better to just wait, if you can, while that payout grows, and use other assets, even if they're assets in your retirement accounts, to tide you over in the meantime. If you're married, it's a little more complicated than that. Generally, it makes sense for the higher wage earner to wait to take Social Security, and the lower earner could start earlier. But there are a lot of complications in that formula. And so I like the idea in your early 60s of running a Social Security calculator, which can cost a little bit of money, but I think it's worth it. It's what I'm going to do when I'm in my early 60s. Larry Kotlikoff, who is a interestingly, a candidate for president and a professor at Boston College. He has one called MaximizeMySocialSecurity.com. I think it's like $49. But if it can save you hundreds of thousands over your lifetime, I think it's pretty much worth it.
Let's take a phone call here. We have Mary Lou in Monroe with us. Mary Lou, go ahead.
Well, good morning. I have one of those complications from Social Security. I plan on collecting my Social Security starting at age 62, which is just about a year and a half from now, simply because I have a young child who will be collecting Social Security for an additional 3.5 years. I've done some hand calculations, and taking the benefits from my child in addition to my reduced benefits at 62, it evens out when I'm 80. So
for most people, it evens out when they're 80. So if you can wait till you're 70, for most people, Mary Lou, it will pay off to wait to age 70. But I understand what you're saying, and I understand what you're saying about the hand back of the envelope sort of calculations. If you're not sure for whatever reason, then I would go ahead and pay the, you know, small bit of money to run one of these calculators. There's another one called Social Security Solutions .com. And at least then you know that the computer's done it for you.
Right. Well, my question is, assuming I do take it at 62, I do plan to continue working. And I understand about the 15,000 plus threshold. If I earn more than this $15,000, it's my understanding that at some point after full retirement age at 66, I get that back. Is that correct? And if it is, exactly how is it do I get it back? Do I get it back dollar for dollar, which I have forfeited in my early 60s?
You know, I don't actually know the answer to that question, and I don't want to lead you down the wrong road. So, again, I would call the Social Security Commission or go online to it's ssn.gov.
Yeah, and actually, I've been on that website, and it's actually pretty user friendly. Mary Lou, good luck with your Social Security questions. Probably the Social Security Administration would be the place to go to get a specific answer to that. Let's talk about people in their 70s. You wrote that it's more important than ever to protect against a market tumble, so we should rebalance our assets at least once a year. So in our 60s, we need to be exposed to the stock market. Now we hit our 70s. That's the time to get more conservative. And how much protection can we realistically have?
So rebalancing doesn't necessarily make you more conservative. And actually, rebalancing is something that you should be doing all along the way. The problem people have when the markets have been going up as steadily as they've been going up since 2009 is that we get a little fat and happy with our returns, and we don't want to swap out of the investments that are doing so well with us in order to plow money back into underperforming categories. But essentially, that's what rebalancing is. Although we all need exposure to stocks in our 60s, our 70s, our 80s, even our 90s, we need a smaller exposure as we age because we have less time to recover from a tumble in the market simply because we're older. When you put together your asset allocation in the beginning, you should have said to yourself, okay, I am 60 years old, and this is just an example, but I am comfortable having 40% of my assets in stocks and the rest of it split between more conservative allocations, or 50% in stocks and the rest split between more conservative allocations. And as you get older, that amount in stocks should go down and down and down and down. It shouldn't go to zero because you still need growth just to keep up with taxes and inflation. But by the time that you're in your 70s, you probably don't want more than, say, 30, 35% in stocks. And by the time that you're in your 80s, maybe 20, 25%.
We're talking about financial strategies in your 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s with nationally renowned personal finance expert Gene Chatsky during this special edition of On Your Money. Kevin McKinley will be back next week. If you have a personal finance question about investing or anything else, give us a call at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email address on your money, all one word, on your money at WPR.org. Or you can post to the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We'll be right back in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. So, I mean, this is a huge problem. We're talking about an enormous amount of money. That all has to get paid back. And if you're paying student loans, you can't be doing other things like saving for retirement.
Well, actually, let's talk about that, because that's not how we want people necessarily to approach this. I had a guest recently on my podcast, which is called Her Money. It's a free weekly podcast, and we talk about all sorts of issues, and including this one. And we got really deep into the question of student loans versus life. And student loan debt, particularly if you're talking about federal loans, the interest rates on those loans this year will fall to, I believe it's 3.7%. They're at an all-time low. And that is something to keep in mind as you go to repay them. The decision between, say, prioritizing making extra headway on your student loans and putting some money in your 401k plan at work where potentially you get a match is a no-brainer. The return that you get on that money that you put into your 401k, particularly if your employer is matching 25 cents on the dollar, 50 cents on the dollar, the 401k return is so far above and beyond the return that you get by paying off those student loans that the smart move is to do whatever you can to reduce the interest rates on your student loans, and there are a number of solutions that you can employ, and then pay those student loans off over time while attempting to make headway with the other parts of your financial life, be it saving for retirement or paying off high interest rate credit card debt, where you get a return that's substantially greater than you get paying off those student loans.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, the number to call to join us on Your Money on the Ideas Network. Gene, what's the first thing students should do to reduce the amount of debt they may owe?
I think these days you need to shop around very carefully when you're looking at where you're going to go to school. And one of my money rules and a good rule of thumb is you want to try to keep the amount of debt you're carrying total at or below the amount that you expect to earn in salary your first year out of school. And there are a number of ways to approach that problem. You want to make sure that you are exhausting your ability to take out federal student loans before you even venture into the private loan market, because private loans are considerably more expensive in most cases. You want to make sure that that you are going to a school that actually wants to have you, that you have applied for as much aid in the form of merit aid and scholarships, as well as doing your best filling out the FAFSA, which is a little different this year because the deadline has moved up. And you also want to think about, can I actually afford this, or should I be doing 2 years in a community college at a significantly lower price tag, and then transferring those credits to a four-year school where you'll earn your ultimate degree?
So if we do need a private loan, what are some things we really need to be aware of?
You need to be aware of the fact that private loans are dependent on credit score and credit rating. You may need a cosigner. Cosigning can be a slippery slope for parents who go down that route or that road, because you can be liable for the debts if the if the primary borrower is unable to pay the money back. But this year in particular, there are some discount programs out there that you may want to be aware of. The folks at Wells Fargo, for example, have teamed up with Amazon Prime. So if your student is an Amazon Prime member, which is a $49 a year price tag, you'll get a percentage point reduction on the interest rate, and that can be combined with other interest rate discounts. So there are a number of programs out there. Sallie Mae has a new program in it for its private borrowers, where if you pay a percentage of or the full interest charges while you're in school, not the principal but the interest, you will see a sizable reduction in the amount that you owe coming out of school. It can reduce the amount that you owe coming out of school by as much as a quarter.
So once we've borrowed the money, how do we figure out the best way to pay it back?
So as I was saying before, you need to look at reducing your interest rate as much as possible. And if you're coming out of school and you borrowed at 6.8%, for example, which is where interest rates stood for a long time, or even higher than that if you had private loans, you may be eligible to refinance your student loans with a private lender. There's been a lot written about companies like Common Bond and SoFi, and you essentially apply for it's a refi, sort of like a mortgage would be refinanced, and you have the ability in some cases to reduce your interest rate. The companies like SoFi, which stands for social finance, they're very interesting. They have sort of shaken up the underwriting process. They're not as concerned with credit score as they are with whether or not you have a job, what college you graduated from. They have agreements in place with thousands of colleges. So that can be something to look at. And there's an interesting tool out there called Gratify, and I'll spell it because I spelled it wrong the first time I heard it. It's Gradify. I believe it's an I, it might be a Y, .com. Anyway, you type in the details of your loans, and it tells you whether you are better off refinancing, paying off on the 10-year schedule that you've gotten, or looking at an income-based repayment program through the federal government. If you have federal loans and you are having trouble making your payments on the original schedule, you might be eligible for something that's part of the repay program. And the repay program is the government's income-based repayment program, which essentially caps the amount that you are asked to pay on a monthly basis to 10 or 15% of whatever it is you earn. And beyond that, if you still have any debt left, 20 years down the road for undergrads, or 25 years if you're a graduate student, that'll be wiped clean. The last thing to keep in mind, and I know I'm giving you a lot of information in addition to it in the answer to one question, but the last thing to keep in mind is public service loan forgiveness. About a quarter of all graduates work in professions that are considered helping professions and that are eligible for public service loan forgiveness, which essentially means that your debt can be wiped away after 10 years. If you're working at a not-for-profit or in some other helping profession in some states, teachers or teachers who are focusing on particular disciplines are eligible, then you want to make sure you start the clock on that, because that can be an incredible benefit.
And it is gratify with an I, but if you do put
Thank
in the
you.
Y, it takes you to the to the site with the I anyway. So either way, you get there, and I believe we have we either have a link now or we will have a link shortly to gratify.com on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let's take a call. Karen is with us from Appleton today. Karen, welcome to On Your Money. Oh, I guess we lost Karen. Let's go to Diane in La Crosse instead. Diane, you're on Your Money.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question regarding a managed 401k retirement plan. We have had this vehicle for several years, about 15 years, and you know, we do pay significant fees to have that account managed. You know, I've been thinking about and hearing more and more about using index funds, index stock funds, and I'm wondering kind of what your opinion is, and you know, how do we choose, et cetera, et cetera.
So I'm of two minds here. So when it comes to managing your 401ks and your other retirement accounts and your brokerage accounts in general, I really am a believer that somebody's got to do the work. And by that I mean, you know, we were talking earlier about asset allocation and making sure that you didn't have too much money in stocks or too little in stocks. Somebody's got to be looking at your accounts and making sure that you're taking the appropriate amount of risk for you and your family as you get older. The managed account solutions do that. They do it in a slightly different way than a target date retirement fund does it. And a target date retirement fund, which generally costs a little less than a managed account option, but not always, is a mutual fund of funds that invests based on your proposed retirement date. So there are funds with names out there like the 2030 fund and the 2040 fund and the 2050 fund that are managing themselves for people who plan to retire at or around that date. Indexing, which is essentially buying a portfolio of various index funds, is cheaper than that. It's cheaper because instead of having a fund manager managing the target date retirement fund or a person managing the managed account option, you're buying a preset portfolio of stocks that adhere to a particular index. And it's been shown that if you invest in index funds year in and year out, you will, on average, beat managed mutual funds, and the big reason for that is that you don't have the expense associated with those managed mutual funds. But buying an index fund only works if you are going to keep yourself in balance, if you're going to keep yourself in line, and you're going to say, if you're doing it with a total stock market index fund and a total bond market index fund, which is a fine way to go about it. Somebody has to make sure that you're allocating the appropriate amount of your money toward stocks and toward bonds. And if you're going to do that yourself, fabulous. And if you know that you're not going to do it yourself, then you should look for a solution where somebody's going to do the work for you.
Let's take another caller. We'll stay in La Crosse. This time, Mike joins us. Mike, hello.
Good morning. And my question is regarding an IRA. I am 67. If I take out 2%, let's say, of that IRA now, when I turn 70 and a half, will I then have to take out what they call the full retirement, which my calculation is about 3.5 at that time, if I start taking out 2% now or next year when I turn 68?
I think it depends on how much you've got at that point, and that depends on the return on your investments. If you haven't sat down with a financial advisor to make a plan for how to tap those assets in general and whether you want to tap those assets and if you're going to need the money, you should do that. And in part, you should do it because if you want to maintain the money, or at least some of the money in the IRA, and you want to do that for long term, for the long term, it may at some point make sense to convert some of those assets into Roth assets where you never have to pull them out. And this is a general recommendation for anybody who's heading into any sort of major life transition. People sometimes think, oh, I can't afford a financial advisor, I don't want to have somebody on my payroll long term. I think at inflection points in your life, getting married, retiring, having a child, buying a house, it makes some sense just to sit down for a consult with somebody who can say, I think you are heading in the right direction, or you want to tweak X, Y, and Z. It doesn't mean you have to see them four times a year, but having an actual plan going forward is, I think, a smart thing to do.
I needed to hear this radio show 40 years ago. Life can involve a number of big events, as you just pointed out, having a baby, retiring, getting married, buying a house. Let's talk about those, starting with having a baby, since that's the beginning of life. You advise that we baby-proof our budget. What does that mean?
It means you look at how much having that addition in your life is going to cost you, and you make sure that you put aside the resources for it. I've got two kids. They are boy, one just got his first job and the other is in college. And so it's been a while since I was baby-proofing my budget. But I know that having babies can be extremely expensive, in part because there are so many things that you want to spend money on besides the things that you have to spend money on. And if you are considering the option of one parent trying to step out of the workforce for a while to stay home with that baby, I think the 9 months of pregnancy gives you a wonderful opportunity to road test living on a single income. And while you're doing that, you should be banking the second salary, which gives you an additional emergency cushion. The other things that you have to do when that baby comes along, or preferably before that baby comes along, and I can't tell you the number of parents who haven't done them, is you have to get a will. A will is the only document that will allow you to name guardians for a minor child, and not naming a guardian is a huge mistake and one countless parents make because they don't want to choose between one spouse's brother and one spouse's sister. It just gets very emotionally fraught. You have to write a will and you have to name guardians. And you also, at this point, even if you haven't invested in a term life insurance policy to protect your spouse, you need to do it to protect your child.
So, shifting gears to retirement, you recommend we withdraw from our own retirement accounts before tapping into Social Security. You did touch on that a little bit, but remind us again, we may have people who just joined us.
Sure. So, when you look at Social Security, your check grows 8% a year from age 62 to age 70. And that growth is baked in. It's guaranteed. And it's tough to replicate in any other way. Guaranteed. And so if you are thinking, I need some money to live on, should I pull it out of my 401k or should I just start the clock on Social Security, the default for many people is, oh, I'll just take Social Security. It's easy, and I'll get it for enough years that it will make up for the fact that my check is smaller. And in reality, that's not the case. If you live past 80 waiting until age 70 to start Social Security is generally the right thing to do. And so you're going to want to wait on Social Security, but take money out of your retirement accounts in order to pay the bills and essentially live.
Okay. This is On Your Money. We're talking with financial expert Gene Chatsky. After the break, we'll get to the top five fights men and women have about money and, more importantly, how to avoid them. We'll also keep taking your personal finance questions. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. On Your Money at WPR.org is the email address, or you can post to the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I need fun.
That's what I want.
That's what I want.
That's what I want.
I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine with you here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to On Your Money. Our guest is Gene Chatsky, financial editor for NBC's Today Show, host of the new Her Money podcast, financial ambassador to AARP, and the author of several books. You know, if I could learn how to read copy, I might have a career in this radio thing. A recent Today Show survey showed that more than a third of respondents said they fight most about different money styles. What is it about money that makes men and women argue so much?
I think it's the fact that opposites attract. And again, you just mentioned my podcast, Her Money. I've had a number of guests on that have confirmed this. And by the way, for people who haven't tuned into Her Money, it is a weekly podcast. It's for women, as it sounds. And we've got fabulous guests like Arianna Huffington and Jillian Michaels and so many other amazing women, Brené Brown, talking about money styles and why money is the thing that makes us feel so rotten about our abilities, when in fact it should be a lot more simple than that. When it comes to our spouses, spenders do tend to attract savers. We like in others what we don't find in ourselves. And financially, that can be somebody who's a little more free or a little more controlled than we are. The problem is that just because you marry somebody doesn't mean that you automatically have all the same wants or needs or goals. And it takes some work to make sure that you're on the same page as far as your joint goals, while still giving each other a little bit of space and a little bit of autonomy so that you can feel like you have enough independence to be a true adult.
So let's talk specifically about how we avoid having that spender versus saver fight. So you talk about common goals. I mean, one of those might be, you know what, we want to buy a house, or we need to buy a new car. How do we avoid arguing about that? How can we make that work?
Well, the best thing to do is to try to go to some sort of neutral territory, and maybe you go out to dinner, or you find a time when you're both in a pretty good mood, and you discuss what your goals are, and you come to not just agreement on what the goal is, but how much the goal is likely to cost, when you want to achieve that goal, and how you're going to get there. And once you've sort of set those parameters in place, it gives you something to look forward to. It gives you something to essentially dream to. This is people think money is like the most unromantic topic on the planet, but this is where money actually gets romantic, because you're thinking about the life that you're planning, that you want to live together. And if you can get on the same page, not just about the what it is, but the when and the how much and the other specifics, then achieving it will become easier. Saving for anything can be difficult. The easiest way to save for any goal, whether it's retirement or a house or college or whatever it is we happen to be talking about, is to save the money automatically before you have the opportunity to spend it. And this is why 401k plans work. This is 401k plans have been successful because they take the money out of your paycheck before you have the opportunity to spend it, and they put it behind barriers where if you want to spend it before you're of retirement age, you have to pay taxes and penalties that are really expensive, and nobody likes doing that. And so most of the time, the money will stay in the 401k. So no matter what goal you're saving for, if you can get yourself to try to replicate that 401k setup, you're going to be better off. And so if you're saving for a house, having money moved automatically right after you get paid out of your checking account into a separate savings account where you are likely to keep your hands off. And one way to do this is to put the money into an internet-based savings account where if you want access to that money, you have to transfer it back to the brick-and-mortar savings account where it takes a couple of days. Just having to think about it and jump through those hoops will make it more likely that you don't do it and that you stay on track to achieve your goal. The other thing that couples really need to understand is that you've got to give each other a little room. You have to give each other a little freedom, a little autonomy, a little independence in the form of money that can be spent without asking the other person for permission.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about when one person makes more money than the other and maybe they feel like he or she has, should have more power?
It's important to think about what the other person is contributing to that relationship. I mean, we were talking about having a baby a few minutes ago, and maybe one person makes more than the other because the other person has decided that they are going to be less aggressive in pursuing their career goals in order to enable them to have more time to take care of the things that the family needs. Those things have value. And the same autonomy that applies in a two-earner couple applies in a couple where one person is either the primary wage earner or the complete wage earner. Even if you are not drawing a salary, you need to have money that is accessible to you for which you can make the decisions. It doesn't have to be a lot of money. It should be proportional to whatever your stage of life is. But it's having the power lie with one person is a very parental approach to a relationship, and it often causes a lot of resentment and a lot of difficulty.
Now, some people are a little more comfortable with risks. Others want to avoid risk like the plague. So what happens when those two personalities get together?
If one dominates, you may end up with too much risk, and if the other dominates, you may end up with too little. And this is where a financial advisor can come in particularly handy in structuring a portfolio that works for the couple as a whole. It's also just important to keep in mind if you've got a retirement plan and your spouse has a retirement plan, you should really take each other into consideration as you're managing your assets for the family as a whole. And that may just mean talking about it. But if one of you is hard-bent on taking a large amount of risk, an inappropriate amount of risk with money, just make it a small amount of money. You know, it's okay to take 5% off the top and call this play money.
Putting it all on 29 black at the roulette table, would that qualify?
That would be my choice. I might prefer to invest in a startup or two, but you know, it's essentially your one is an informed risk and one is just a risk.
Yeah. One is recreation. Finally, couples fight about whether to lend money to family members. You say lending is just a bad idea. How come?
It is. It's just a bad idea because it wreaks havoc with relationships. And if you can afford to help the family member and you want to help the family member, I would say make it a gift. And make it a one-time gift and let the family member know that there is nothing more where this came from.
Mm-hmm. We had a question from Kay in Appleton who called in wanting to know if it's valuable to own property and save it as an inheritance for children.
It's certainly valuable to own property. I think the question is, do your children want that property? And if it's investment property, do your children want to be landlords? Do they have the capacity to manage the property? One of the things that we often talk about when we talk about reverse mortgages is that parents believe they should be saving this property for their children because their children really want it, and the children often don't. So look into, you know, why you're actually doing this, and are you doing it for you or are you doing it for them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because sometimes you can end up getting stuck with a piece of property that you have trouble selling, and now you've got property taxes and whatnot to pay. We've got about a minute left. What are you going to be talking about in your next podcast?
My next podcast is with Joanne Jenkins, and Joanne is the CEO of AARP. Relatively new in that position, and she talks a lot about redefining aging and defying aging, that we are living so much longer that we get to have an entirely new adventure in many cases once we get into our 60s and our 70s and beyond. It's a really interesting conversation. But for those people who haven't tuned in, they're all on iTunes and Stitcher and SoundCloud. You can go back and you can start at the beginning with our podcast with Gretchen Rubin, who talked about money and happiness, and listen all the way through. And please, you know, for the women who are listening to this show, if you like it, leave us a review, share it with your friends, and let us know who you'd like us to feature as guests.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
Thanks. Bye.
Jean Chatsky, financial editor for NBC's Today Show, host of the new Her Money podcast, financial ambassador to AARP, and the author of a number of books. On Your Money is broadcast live each Tuesday morning at 8 and repeated Saturdays at noon. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will be back next week. This hour was produced by Bill Martins and Brian Chasso. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.